Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize. Coming to you today from the Institute on Science for Global Policy, we have me, Cleo.
Daniela.
And Aubrey here. Just as a reminder for you all, you can check out previous episodes of The Forum by looking us up on SoundCloud or iTunes.
And you can connect with us by tweeting at ISGPForum while using the hashtag ISGPForum, and also by searching ISGP's The Forum on Facebook. Pick your social media poison, and we've got you covered.
In today's conversation, we're going to be focusing on genomics, recent research in the field, and what it all means for both urban developed nations and more rural, less affluent regions.
Turns out, the implications are pretty different depending on where you are in the world. And when it comes to impacts, we need to start paying particular attention to Africa specifically. At least, that's the case according to Dr. Vanessa Hayes' policy position paper titled Translating Technical Advances in Genomics to the Developing World, Addressing Cultural Needs as Part of Policymaking.
You can check out the paper for yourself by going to scienceforglobalpolicy.org and searching under the Publications tab.
Dr. Hayes is a professor of genomic medicine at the J. Craig Venter Institute in San Diego, California, as well as an honorary professor of medical sciences at the University of Limpopo in the Limpopo province of South Africa. She presented and defended the paper in question at the Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases Focus on Societal and Economic Context Conference held at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, from July 8th to the 11th in 2012.
To begin, let's cover a little bit of background on genomics as a science discipline. And to our dedicated listeners, hang in there if you've heard this spiel before on another one of our episodes. We just want to make sure everyone, including forum first-timers, are on the same page.
So the study of genomics focuses on the hereditary information of an organism, encoded in either DNA or RNA, and consists of the technical and computational advances in generating and deciphering the DNA code of living organisms. According to Dr. Hayes, genomic medicine is, quote, the use of information from the genome, for example, the complete DNA sequence of a human and/or pathogen, to guide clinical management, end quote.
These efforts have, in many ways, revolutionized medical research efforts, including those targeting emerging and persistent infectious disease, or EPID as an acronym, and have created an era of genomic medicine.
Genomics, as a field, has undergone significant advancements within the last two decades. This progression of scientific achievements can be put on a timescale of sorts to give you an idea of just how rapidly this stuff is advancing.
Alrighty, time machine activated. In 1995, scientists sequenced the very first bacterial genome,
the Haemophilus influenzae genome.
And just 8 years later, the Human Genome Project was completed in 2003. Launched in 1990, this project consisted of an international effort to identify and map all the genes that make up a human from both a physical and functional standpoint. So, understanding their sequence and where they're located in the genetic code, as well as knowing what they do.
The draft sequence of the human genome became a reference used to spot DNA variations that indicate a person's disease susceptibility, most likely disease outcomes, or predicted response to treatments.
While scientific understanding of genomics has improved considerably in a very short period of time, something scientists still struggle with is the prediction of phenotype from genotype. Basically, your genotype is the genetic trait information you inherit from your parents, and your phenotype is the physical manifestation of that genotype. So, in a pretty basic example, a certain DNA sequence might encode for eye color, so you'd have a certain genotype for your eye color. But the resulting phenotype could be green, blue, brown, hazel, you get the idea. In many cases, one genotype can result in several different phenotypes depending on other genes or even on environmental factors.
The genotype-phenotype relationship is difficult to decipher because of both the influence of changing environments and the substantial number of genes that contribute to most phenotypes.
The study of genomics has demonstrated that humans, regardless of their geographic origin, are genetically 99% identical to one another. It's the remaining 1% difference in genetic makeup, so basically DNA, that not only leads to different physical appearances, but also leads to distinct health characteristics in individuals.
Another thing genomics helps us with is examining humans' microbial makeup. That's right, Forum family. We interrupt this program to remind you to say hello to your friendly, up close and personal microbial neighbors. Research has demonstrated that all humans are not exactly all human. Instead, we coexist with millions of microbes both in and on our bodies. In fact, the number of microbial genes existing within each person exceeds the number of human genes 10 to 1 in any given healthy adult.
I think I'm going to vomit.
Don't be so dramatic, Cleo. Although, honestly, you get sick so often that I'm not sure you have any microbes in your body at all. Well, at least not the ones that help keep you healthy.
I'm inclined to agree with Aubrey here.
Stop ganging up on me.
Anyway, while some of these microbes definitely help us, others do more harm than good, and extensive microbial diversity impacts health status and infectious diseases. Genomic studies have thus become useful tools in identifying these microbes without the need for timely and sensitive lab cultures, and we easily can examine them and their relationships with our bodies.
Okay, so now that we all hopefully have a general appreciation for genomics, let's discuss one of the main objectives of this debate. While the progression of genomics is all well and good, the current reality is this. Although the benefits of genomics are widespread in the Western world, the regions where infectious disease often arise and reach epidemic levels have largely been excluded from the genomics revolution.
A focal point of both Dr. Hayes' paper and the ensuing debate was Africa. In order to fully understand the importance of this continent to today's conversation, let's continue by giving a little bit more background and context.
Good idea. Africa is the second largest continent on Earth and home to 1/6 of the world's population, as well as about 2,000 linguistic groups, which, by the way, represent about as many distinct cultures.
According to the World Health Organization, or the WHO, Africa is home to the highest recorded mortality rates for the top three infectious diseases in existence.
Which are?
Malaria, tuberculosis, which is often referred to as TB, and HIV/AIDS. Not a great trio there.
Certainly not. Unfortunately, we have some pretty sobering numbers coming up too, so prepare yourselves. The United Nations Children's Fund, better known as UNICEF, and the WHO have determined that malaria claims the life of a child in Africa every 30 seconds.
In 2010, more than 270 cases of TB per 100,000 people were recorded for sub-Saharan Africa.
And by 2010, an estimated 15.7 million children in sub-Saharan Africa had lost at least one parent to AIDS.
So basically, Africa has a lot of people, a lot of cultures, and a lot of EPID-related issues, ones that could be addressed with the information found through genomic research. The problem is that these very people who could greatly benefit from genomics have been largely excluded from the genomic revolution.
That's right. Throughout the development of genomic databases, there has been a strong bias towards obtaining information from individuals of European descent.
And this bias is not only hurting those in Africa, but really everyone else too, who could benefit from therapies rooted in genomic research. Studies have shown that improved understanding of genetic variation in humans, so susceptibility to a disease and its progression, for instance, holds promise for developing therapeutic interventions.
Especially for diseases like HIV/AIDS, it's critical for African genetic variation to be more fully represented in research. This is important for, the whole continent, because this disease has a high prevalence in the region, but also for HIV/AIDS research in general.
And when it comes to disease research and epidemiology, sometimes there are certain strains of a disease that are more prevalent in one region than another, or even some that only exist in one location. As such, the debaters noted that research must more broadly encompass strains of disease like HIV that occur mainly in less affluent regions, such as HIV2, in order to ensure that efforts to prevent and control the disease will be more effective.
Also, for completeness, let's clarify that HIV1 and HIV2 are genetically distinct viruses. HIV1 is the variety that exists pretty much everywhere and is the most common, while HIV2 is concentrated in West Africa and, as a disease, tends to progress a bit slower than HIV1 in the body.
The message that the world outside of Africa needs to start addressing the significant role the continent has played and continues to play in shaping the globe. We're talking human origins all the way to the large biodiversity of the continent that has led to quite a number of EPID outbreaks.
And in a more overarching, existential, good of science sense, examining a diversity of disease strains is also significant in terms of researchers' improved understanding of global variations in human DNA sequences, which could lead to valuable discoveries related to human infectious disease susceptibility. And susceptibility, I think, really is key here. I mean, if we could predict with any kind of reliability whether or not a person is bound to get a disease, it would be so much easier to prevent that disease if it's in fact preventable, or even just be prepared to address the disease when it actually arises.
And while all this diversity makes Africa a relevant and highly important subject, it also makes the use of genomic data in this region much more challenging.
Translating the genomic data that's relevant to healthcare and EPID response within the context of Africa cannot occur without considering Africa's cultural diversity. For Africa, there is no one-size-fits-all intervention approach.
Definitely not. Efforts need to be made to include the changing needs of local groups into decision-making as much as possible.
Not to mention, the predominantly rural nature of the continent combined with infrastructure deficiencies,
like roads and electrical power that really leave something to be desired,
are all impediments to ensuring that infectious disease control activities reach those who need them.
There's no denying the elephant in the room that fancy things like genomics and medical therapies cost money, and that countries within Africa suffer from widespread poverty, both at the country and individual levels. While many donor initiatives have been instrumental in building capacity for things like molecular diagnostics, donors tend to shift their attention and funds to various regions and diseases.
For example, one day a donor could have a desire to help address HIV/AIDS in Uganda, but then feel pulled to help fight the Ebola outbreaks in Sierra Leone.
This impedes the maintenance and overall long-term success of the very programs that the donors are kind enough to begin.
Okay, well, I think it's time we start incorporating some solutions or high points into the conversation here before our listeners fall into a deep depression thinking that addressing infectious disease in Africa is a lost cause, because it's really not.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that one. To start, the debaters believe that some of the infrastructural shortfalls that have previously limited genomics research in Africa could be addressed through technological advances.
For example, when good computational networks are instituted, scientists in Africa can work together with researchers in more affluent countries through cloud computing. This could mean that many of the machines and staff that would otherwise physically be necessary in Africa would frequently not be required.
Now, while technology should be capitalized on whenever possible, we also need to be cognizant of viewing new technologies as a wholesale substitute for other forms of capacity building in Africa. We need to make sure that we don't neglect problems that technology can't currently address.
Like, for example, the fact that research and development for therapeutics is expensive, and therefore, the end cost of drugs or vaccines reflects this expense. It's this high cost that may prohibit both individuals in less affluent regions and impoverished individuals within more affluent regions from accessing the help they need.
Another major issue, and something the debaters grappled with, was the balance between short and long-term needs of individuals throughout the world, given the limited economic resources available globally.
Wait, didn't we just establish that this genomics research and the help it could provide is, I don't know, very important?
We have in fact been doing that for the last 10 minutes or so, but think of this. How do we prioritize the encouragement and advancement and gung-ho-ness, for lack of better terms, of a longer-term genomic revolution compared to public health measures that are pretty darn important, such as the provision of fresh drinking water or disease vector control, immunizations, and improved nutrition, all of which impart immediate benefits on the ground?
Wow, okay, well, that was a snapback to reality. Do we have an answer for this?
Well, not really, but it's definitely something we need to keep in the back of our heads as something to consider.
As if we weren't juggling enough challenges in this episode.
I know, but no one said this job would be easy. We are all taking one for the global team here. Education is power.
Very true. All right, so let's talk more about what we need to be doing to ensure that the benefits of genomic research don't fall through the cracks and that these benefits actually reach the people who could use them. For instance, partnerships could be a useful tool.
To ensure the success of infectious disease control efforts, there is a desperate need for stronger collaborations and partnerships between regions and professional and academic disciplines. and we're mainly talking between less wealthy and more wealthy countries in this instance.
These potential collaborations could, in theory, reduce costs and increase effectiveness. What we need to be careful of, though, is the sustainability of these partnerships. It's really important that initiatives don't launch and then just fizzle off, which has already been a recurring issue in the past.
The sustainability of infectious disease and other health programs is improved when bottom-up community approaches are instituted in cooperation with the top-down national or regional initiatives.
Encouraging local responsibility for implementing policies while simultaneously targeting resources to where they're most needed can be helped along by engaging local representatives to participate in the decision-making processes that establish EPID priorities and strategies.
When embarking on the implementation of genomic research in the context of Africa, it's important that we take into account the lessons learned from past failures between the scientific community and disadvantaged populations.
An infamous example we can mention is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. This clinical study was conducted between 1932 and 1972 by the U.S. Public Health Service as they were studying the natural progression of untreated syphilis in rural African American men in Alabama. However, and prepare yourself for the unethical here, this study was performed under the guise that these men were receiving free health care from the United States government when this was not entirely the case. At first, the men received free medical care, meals, and free burial insurance for participating in the study. Shortly after, though, funding for the treatment was lost, but the study was continued without informing the men they would never be treated. None of the men infected were ever told they had the disease, and none were treated with penicillin, even after the antibiotic became proven for treatment of syphilis.
All right, so besides that piece of info making you cringe, it also serves as a reminder of what good science definitely does not do.
So, in an attempt to avoid ethical mishaps of the past, future studies should seek to include social scientists, natural scientists, and historians in the research planning and performing processes. All of these disciplines can really work together internationally across multiple communities to develop acceptable codes of behavior for genomics research.
And if we succeed in this interdisciplinary research, there's potential for the benefits to move beyond ethics. Genomic research already has a pretty high value from a purely scientific standpoint, but its value can increase even more if the resulting knowledge is integrated with information from the environments in which we all live, such as social, cultural, economic, political, and physical environments.
So, listeners, I think we're going to leave you with a few questions to ponder.
Ready? Here we go. How can we best build bridges between non-African and African countries to ensure that genomic research benefits all people?
How do you prioritize infectious disease alleviation through genomics research in comparison to things like clean water initiatives?
And ultimately, is Africa ready for this revolution? Are we as scientists and policymakers ready to accept the challenges of making the genomic revolution work for and not against Africa?
Tweet us at ISGP Forum and use the hashtag ISGP Forum in all of your questions or comments.
Well, we hope you found today's episode informative and motivating. Let's use these heavy topics today as inspiration for improving the future. From all of us here at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thanks so much for socializing with science, and we'll catch you next time right here on the Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.